Thank you. I will assume that most of you or all of you believe or at least have heard talks about the various sources of astrophysical sources of neutrinos, so I will not try to convince you that they may exist. I'll stick to the facts. So NESTOR is what? It's an acronym. Neutrino Extended Telescope with Oceanographic Research. It's a German, Greek, Russian, Swiss, American collaboration. What's John? John is responsible for converting many of us into the field. Well, we're trying to get money, okay, from other fields other than high energy physics, and applied physics brings money in. So we have to talk the oceanographers into funding part of the project. That's why they're there. So John is at least responsible for converting me into a lover of the field of neutrino astronomy. It's a hard field, it's not easy. And it's, thank you. If you want to see names, the American part is Hawaii, John and some friends, and Berkeley, namely David Nygren and his crew. They have provided us with the electronics that is necessary. Also Hugh Bradner, some of you might remember Brad from the LBL days, who is now at Scripps, has been extremely helpful with us.
We're skipping all those transparencies.
All right. Listen, I'll put the interesting ones up. Okay, as a Greek, I have to start with a historical reference. Pliny the Youngest, in his treatise, Historia Naturalis, says that I believe that there are some crazy people who go inside mines to study the stars. Now, you might laugh, but when you think about it, it's not so crazy. The name of the game in experimental physics is signal to noise. And when God controls the signal, as is the case with astrophysical sources, the only thing you can do as an experimentalist is control the noise, the background. So what the ancients used to do, if they wanted to observe the stars at daytime, they would go down into deep vertical mine shafts, therefore getting rid of most of the sunlight. And they could actually observe stars, culminating stars at daytime. So this is what I'm going to talk to you about, how to do the same thing with neutrinos. So, neutrino astronomy is a field that is essentially born, and the Nobel Prize awards this year testify to that. But that refers to low energy neutrino astronomy. High energy neutrino astronomy is not quite there yet. It's getting there. And this is what we're working on. I'm not an astronomer, I'm a particle physicist. So I kid myself by saying that I know how to detect elementary particles. And if you go down the list of elementary particles, if you want to do astronomy by not using photons, but another elementary particle, you'll see that the only particles you can use are neutrons and neutrinos. But neutrons beta decay. And despite the Lorentz boost, time dilation, etc., you cannot do extra galactic astronomy by using neutrons. So you have to use neutrinos. Okay? Question is, do you know the level at which neutrinos are present? Well, you don't really. You can speculate and you do calculations, but if you look at the cosmic ray spectrum, you can see particles extending all the way up to 10 to the 20th electron volts. So neutrinos must be there. The question is, at what level? So what physics can you do with neutrino telescopes? Well, first of all, neutrino astronomy, which is the major emphasis of this field. But then you can also do, hopefully, particle physics, physics beyond the standard model, like searching for dark matter particles, or by using the very, very high energy neutrinos you should be able to find in the cosmos to do particle physics, multiply WZ production, search for substructure, etc. There's various models that I'm sure you know better than me. Then the other pieces of physics you can do, as Super Kamiokande has beautifully demonstrated, neutrino oscillations. You can do long baseline neutrino oscillations with an earthly accelerator. You can improve decays, limits to proton decays, because the neutrinos are the ultimate background to the signal, supernova, magnetic monopoles. And what is I find most exciting is what I cannot talk to you about. We're supposed to open up a new window in a neighborhood of the universe that nobody has ever looked at before. But then you come down to the nitty-gritty. And you say, okay, that list of physics that I just put up, it's a big shopping list. And on first look, it seems that the experimental requirements are contradictory. Low energy threshold versus high energy threshold. High photocathode coverage versus low photocathode coverage, etc. So how do you do it? Well, I think the approach must be stepwise, in such a way that the experiment we're doing today measures the background of the experiment we're going to be doing tomorrow. So if one takes a step-by-step approach, I think one can meet this rather ambitious list of physics goals. And now, how do you observe neutrinos? After all, astronomy means pointing. You must say, hey, there's a source there. Well, you do that by detecting the muon, which is produced in charge current nu mu interactions. This is the angular accuracy that one can achieve. So for TV neutrinos, you can get 1 degree, accuracy of about 1 degree, and by accumulating statistics, we can do better than that. So point astronomy with neutrinos is possible, but you have to go deep. You have to go deep because the signal to noise on the Earth's surface is 10 to the minus 12. Okay, I don't know of anybody that knows how to deal with this kind of signal to noise. So you have to reduce the background by about 6 orders of magnitude. And you know how people do that? By going inside mines. Now, if you go inside a mine, you are restricted in the size of your detector. So the biggest detector you can have is like Super Kamiokande, which is in a stope, which is what, 50 by 50 by 50? Or, but I mean, yeah. So you cannot dig a bigger tunnel than this. So the only way out is to go to the sea. But before we get into the nitty gritty, let me also blow the bugle of neutrino astronomy. That if you compare neutrino astronomy to gamma ray astronomy, you'll see that with neutrinos, you have the extra advantage that they don't get attenuated, neither at the production site, not during their long trip into the cosmos. So if you want to measure the production spectrum at the source, you have to do it with neutrinos. You cannot do it with gamma rays. And also with neutrinos, you should be able to see further out and deeper into the cosmos. Another extra advantage that you get by detecting neutrinos is neutrinos can only be produced in hadronic processes, while gamma rays can be produced in electromagnetic processes, synchrotron radiation, inverse condensation scattering, etc. So hopefully I have convinced you of the usefulness of neutrino astronomy for those of you that are more particle physics oriented. Let me remind you that if neutralinos exist and they are massive, then they are attracted by heavenly bodies. They are attracted in the center of heavenly bodies. They collide. Their velocity goes below the escape velocity, and the eons of times that go by. neutralino meets antineutralino, they annihilate. Depending on the mass, various things are produced, but the end product is neutrinos. So a very interesting particle physics experiment to do is to look at the center, at the sun, the center of the Earth, or the center of the galaxy for copious neutrino production, which come from neutralino decays. So the most experiments concentrate on high energy neutrinos because the cross section and the muon range go up, they improve, so they give you an extra advantage. So the two or three now, with Amanda, three experiments that are doing that are Macro, Super Kamiokande, and Amanda, but they are of the order of 1,000 square meters. You need to go to do better by a couple of orders of magnitude. An ice cube, which was just approved, is doing just that. But to do some finances, if you use conventional particle detectors, then you'll see that you need a first order budget of the order of a billion, 1 to 2 billion Swiss francs. This is the sun budget for a year or two. So nobody's going to give you the money. And this is where the water Cherenkov technique comes in. Markov proposed it, first of all, back in the early 60s, and many physicists have worked very hard to develop that into a proper and a well-accepted detection technique. John is one of the pioneers of the of this technique. And fundamentally, for those of you that wonder what happens is, you detect the Cherenkov light that's produced by the muon. Muon has a long range, it goes many kilometers inside water. Okay, so if you get an energetic neutrino interacting in the water, making a muon, even if that muon is 2 or 3 kilometers away from your detector, if it points towards your detector, you have a good chance of exploiting it and detecting it. And then the technique is nothing else but making a sky map. This is the Macro and the Super K sky maps. Of neutrino candidates, and you look for statistical, well, you look for concentrations that are above statistical fluctuations. That's how you identify point sources. So it's very important to have as little background as possible and as high an angular resolution as possible, because the smaller the angular bins you can divide the sky map into, the better a chance you have to detect a source. All these are atmospheric neutrinos. These are atmospheric neutrinos and badly reconstructed muons. Downcoming muons reconstructed as upcoming. This is consistent with background. There's just no source. I should have, and I should make an Amanda plot, but it's similar.
These are mostly around
one jet. Well, the Amanda ones are higher, a little higher in energy, but it's a good
same.
So, this is why we go inside water. We can go very deep, okay? Then the water is the target, the active medium of detection, and the shield. And similar for ice. So, it's not that we're masochists that we want to work in the bottom of the sea, is we have no choice. So, essentially, the experiment one is doing, it's explained in Greek to you down here. You have the Earth, you have your detector somewhere, you try to detect extraterrestrial neutrinos, but you have a background. That background is caused either by muons from cosmic rays interacting in the atmosphere that reach your detector, okay, or from neutrinos again produced by cosmic rays. So this is the ultimate thing you have to deal with, okay? And essentially what you were looking at in the previous graph are either muons that are misreconstructed as upcoming and one thinks that they're neutrinos, or neutrinos, but that they come from the atmosphere, and therefore they are of no interest for this piece of physics. I mean, that's how Super Kamiokande measured the neutrino oscillations. The other thing one should note is the range of the muon in water as a function of its energy. You can see that an 1 TeV muon has an energy of about a range of about 2 kilometers in water. And this is where you win by being in water and not in rock, because you can see far out outside your detector. While if you have your experiment in a cavity, you cannot see beyond the edges of the cavity. I will get into that in about 1 second. So depending on your background and on your culture, you can make a hole in the ice and look on the other side. And this is what they do on the South Pole or in Lake Baikal. Or if you're a soft Greek like me, you make a hole in the water and you look at the other side. Okay, but now, as Tony says, how deep is the Mediterranean? But before we get to that, let me try and convince you that it's very important to be as deep as possible. This is work done by Victor Stenger for Dumand, and we use Dumand as a generic detector because Dumand is the progenitor of us all. Okay, so Dumand could get an angular accuracy of the order of 1 square degree. So he calculated what are the backgrounds in Dumand at a depth of 4,800 meters. First of all, and after a year's running, what events would these backgrounds cause, okay, for Dumand? So potassium 40 and other random noise was about 0.4 per, of an event per year per square pixel of 1 degree. Now, you cannot do much about this background by changing the depth, because the water salinity changes only by a few percent. Single cosmic ray muons, which are misreconstructed because of experimental error, would be 0.6 events per year, multiple cosmic ray muons, 0.15, and atmospheric neutrinos, 0.13. Well, atmospheric neutrinos, no matter where you go in depth, you cannot get rid of them. The only thing you can do is try and get as good an angular resolution as possible. Adding all these up, you get 1.3 events per year per pixel of 1 degree. Note that the main source of background is the downcoming muons. So if you want to do a 5 sigma discovery experiment, you have to go 1 times 5. You need about 6, you need a source that produces at least 6 muons per pixel per year. So take the same detector with the same cuts, both hardware and software, and put it at a depth of 1,000 meters. Then the potassium 40 and the atmospheric neutrino background is the same, but what scales up by about a factor of 500 is the downcoming muons. Okay? And you see that you get about 400 fake events per year. Just take this and multiply this sum and multiply it by 500. The square root of 400 is 20, so the minimum flux that you can detect is 5 times 20, 100, so you need 100 events per pixel per year. While at the bigger depth of 4.8 kilometers, you need 6. So you lose about almost 2 orders of sensitivity by being shallow. So this is a very important point. Well, you do, but at what level? Okay, if you want to distinguish it at the level of 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th, then you have to reduce the background as much as possible. The more shallow you are, the more of that background you let in. I mean, it's how good your electronics is. Okay, but the same experiment at 4,500 meters is almost 2 orders of magnitude more sensitive than the same experiment at 1,000 meters, okay? So I don't buy the argument, my experiment is good enough, I can kill background because I get these numbers at 1,000 meters. The answer to that, take that same experiment with the same cuts, your own smartness, and go deeper. You improve your chances by 2 orders of magnitude, and that's very important. And this is why Tony was asking, how deep does the Mediterranean get? If you want to see, it depends on which background you're talking about. The potassium 40, again, Let me answer it in a different way. Potassium 40 is omnipresent in the sea. It's not in the ice, in the Antarctic ice. Okay? And no matter where you go, you get the same background. But if you want to see as far outside your detector as possible, you have to make your requirements as low as possible. That is, you need 6 photoelectrons, one per phototube. Okay, so yes, if I go to PV, then there's more light, Cherenkov light produced, so I'm more effective, but I lose an area, ineffective area. So it's a game that you never win unless you go very deep.
So the potassium is always there even if you go to higher energy?
Potassium is there, and I'll show you some data on potassium. We think now that we've studied it for a month that we can get around it, but it's not a question of PV versus TV. Because if you go to PV, then you go to significantly lower fluxes. So you want to be able to be sensitive for muons passing very far outside your detector. So you want to drop the number of photons that you want to detect. Okay? So this is the rate of downcoming muons as measured by us another experiment. So the difference between 4 kilometers depth and 2 kilometers depth is a factor of 80. Hi, Gail. Long time no see. Sorry. Now, before you, well, okay. So this is a geomorphological map of the Mediterranean. Can you see it? The deepest part is in the southwest corner of Greece, 5,200 meters. Okay. There's a spot south of Italy that's 3,500 meters, and there's a spot, or many spots, one in Marseille, where Antares is trying to take data now, at 2,000 meters. So the deepest is there.
It's interesting to me that it's not somewhere in the middle of
there. Why should it be the middle? yes and no. It's, I mean, there's no causal. There it is, you're looking at it. This is Athens. There is where we're operating right now, 4,200 meters. And the deepest part is a few kilometers away at 5,000 meters. It's where the subduction, the African plain, goes under Europe and goes bang, bang, bang. And that's how the Alps were formed. Okay? Now, the other question you will be asking me, okay, depth is not the only thing you should be looking at. What is the seeing time? What sources are you sensitive to? This is a plot, it's an old plot, of viewing time versus declination. This is Amanda looking at the north hemisphere. It's a shallow detector, so it cannot quite look at the horizon. It can look about 10, 20 degrees below the horizon. You can see that. If you look at the Amanda sky map, which they just published, you can see a band of events on the horizon. That's background. Okay, that's Baikal. The red is Nestor, and the green is Dumont. And this graph does not argue for two detectors in the Mediterranean, as is the case right now, but it argues for a detector in the Mediterranean and a detector in the Pacific. The combination of Amanda, a detector in the Pacific, let's say Dumont, revisited, risen, whatever, and Nestor in the Mediterranean, would monitor the cosmos continuously. Nicely. Antares and Nestor is the same, as far as declination goes, except for one big difference. Antares is shallow, so Antares cannot see up to the horizon. Antares, at best, can see about 20 degrees below the horizon. We, being deep, can look about 20 degrees above the horizon. And that's very important when you get to the PV energies, because the Earth, as you know, starts absorbing neutrinos after about 100 TeV. By the time you're at 400, 500 TeV, it absorbs everything. So the only chance you have is to look for downcoming, because above 10 TeV, there's hardly any background. But then you have to be able to have phototubes looking up. Antares has a sedimentation problem because of the Rhone, Marseille, and Toulon. Within 3 months, the upward looking phototubes are completely covered in silt and other bad things. Okay, so they cannot not look up. That's why they have phototubes looking down. And you can look sideways into the horizon. Now the difference between looking 20 degrees below the horizon and 20 degrees above the horizon is large, you know, factors of 3 or 4 in solid angle. Okay? Well, Baikal is at a latitude of, what is it, 45, 50 degrees? That's the difference. Yeah, that's all. But between all the Mediterranean detectors, we have this curve with plus minus 20 degrees around the horizon. Now, if you want to look at some sources, what is above and below the horizon, etc., what you really are interested in is to look also at the galactic center, which is something that Amanda cannot really look at, okay, because it's in the southern hemisphere. So both the seeing is good and the depth is good, and what I'm going to be talking to you about is data that we have taken by having detectors in this plateau, which is only 7.5 miles, nautical miles, from the closest shore. It makes a big difference in operations. So assuming that I have convinced you of that, let me just give you the summary of the properties of the site. Well, first of all, you need clean water. It doesn't matter really. It's almost symmetric. First of all, we did a large number of studies by taking samples and doing from various depths in that general area and taking, doing a full spectral analysis with a monochromator on these samples. Took about 47 samples. And you can see this is the attenuation coefficient is of the order of 0.02. The inverse of it is the absorption length, the transmission length. It's about 50 meters water. We put photometers down in the deep, but all these are instruments that are tabletop instruments. They have a flight path of the order of 2 meters. We're high energy physicists, we don't like that. So with Hugh Bradner from Scripps, we measured the water transmissivity by having a source, a detector, and changing the distance between the source and the detector by having a cable. So we went up to about 50 meters distances, and we measured that the transmission length is about 55 meters, which is very good. We took many photographs of the bottom. It's nice, solid clay. We measured the bioluminescence. It's of the order of 1%. And I'll just give you the summary of the properties. By the way, if any of you wants to look at what the bottom of the sea looks like, at 4,000 meters. This distance is 25 centimeters. It's dull. I mean, there's nothing there.
What are those white things? Those aren't fish.
No, I think these are scratches on the photograph. We did find one Coke can. Okay, it was there, yeah. Or Coke or beer, you know, something, soft drink. I mean,
we
we've...
perfectly preserved.
Yeah. That's right. Carrots are there. That is samples that go down as 2 meters deep. The ultimate background there is dust from Sahara. When the Sirocco blows, it brings dust from the Sahara. And that settles down eventually. So these are the properties of the site. So there's a plateau that's about 8 by 9 kilometers. The depth is around 4,000 meters. The optical properties are excellent, about 55 meters transmission. The underwater currents are minimal, a few centimeters per second, and the sedimentology is very encouraging. So you say, okay.
Do you have to worry about stuff growing on the optical?
You do, but whatever tests we have made don't really show anything at the depth of 4,000 meters because there's no light. Below 1,500 meters, there's hardly any light. And the deeper you go, there's less oxygen also.
But I guess you don't really know.
Well, no, we have... No, we have, if it takes 20 years to grow, it does not bother me. I'll be long. I'll be dead by then. If it's 2 years, then it should worry me. But we've left stuff down there for over 2 years, and we have not seen, at least by eye and a magnifying lens, anything that is...
Oh, it's true. In the deep ocean, if you get, once you get below around 1,500 meters or so, growth is not a problem. It's just not enough living over, just not enough going on.
That's right.
A desert down there.
You mentioned the dust from the Sahara. That doesn't interfere with the stroke.
No, but this is the ultimate background.
The
I mean, eventually that dust will settle on the photo chips. Now, on the some of it will be washed away, or most of it, because of the underwater currents. Now, what's the probability of that dust sticking onto the photo chip? I don't know. We have not seen any measurable effects over a year. So maybe at the 40-year level it is a problem, but it's not at the few-year level. So, having done that, you can play things like you can have windshield wipers. Okay, I mean, there's things you can do, but they're expensive, and you don't want to. It's better to bring your detector up, scrub it down, and then put it down. Okay, now that area has another advantage. That it's on a 2D projection. It's on the same beam line from CERN to Gran Sasso. In fact, we designed the Gran Sasso beam. The first published design of the Gran Sasso beam was done by us for Nestor. The Italians paid, 50 million Swiss francs, so it's optimized for there. In our case, because the Earth is spherical, the beam passes about 80 kilometers above us. You can still try and think of doing off-axis experiments. Also, the transfer tunnel is at CERN is designed such that if we have a good case to retarget the beam towards Nestor, then a new tunnel will have to be dug, but with minimum civil engineering. It's part of the design. Okay? Excuse me? Yeah, about 1753. It's twice the distance to Gran Sasso. Okay, so this is just by accident. And the other thing I want to emphasize here is the proximity to many harbors. So the idea is you lay a cable to the nearest village. There's 1, 2, 3 harbors within, say, 8 to 10 miles, and a beautiful bay, Navarino Bay, which is about 17 miles away. So the location is optimal for 4,000 meters depth, and as I said, 5,200 is nearby. So all this fortified us to go and ask for money from the Greek government. This is our institute on the water. It houses, offices, first of all, administration, some labs, computer center. It's nice. This is what it looked like when we took over it. We had to do major civil engineering. It's the old gymnasium of Pylos.
That's a pretty big center.
Yeah, it's 1,000 square meters. Always. We had Chris Quigg for a month last summer, etc. So you are very welcome to come. I should flip this. Yeah. That's Peter Koske, one of our German collaborators, going for his daily swim. Now, this is what the city of Pylos looks like. Oh. There it is. There is the institute. There's the institute building, there's a castle, and our machine shops are there, and I'll show you some photographs of our machine shops. So it's a small, nice town.
And a nice old port down there.
Yeah, we had the CERN summer school last summer there, the CERN Dubna. And we had the lectures up in the castle, and the parallel sessions in the institute.
The fish is
excellent.
several tens of years, right?
Yes. So we get about a GV down there.
You can detect what would be your threshold energy.
Ah, then we have to redesign the detector. You cannot optimize, you cannot use the same detector for TV neutrinos and, in fact, Dedek, Friedrich Dedek is proposing such an experiment closer to Italy than us, but with a dense detector. I'll just show you, these are machine shops. So we have set up, we spent a couple of years trying to build the infrastructure, and we have done so. John has visited us. We have a full machine shop for those of you who are interested. And in fact, we're the only place in Greece and one of the very few in Western Europe that can work with titanium. Gratis our Russian colleagues. But the important thing is we have a test station that works 360 days a year. This is the Bay of Navarino. This is the village of Pylos. There's the lab. And we have a 5.5 kilometer cable that goes on the other side of the bay. And all systems are tested there for a couple of months before they're deployed in the deep. It's very important to have this facility. For instance, here you see in the Bay of Navarino trying to learn how to deploy things. You'll see that in a second. And this is another counting room we have. This is in the nearby village of Methoni. This is where our cable comes out to shore. So we have built the infrastructure. What about the experiment? First of all, most of you think that we should be using or we have to use robots. A robot is a complicated thing. In order for a robot to operate, you need a surface vessel which has an umbilical cable that goes to a garage, and out of the garage comes out the robot, which drags behind it a cable. That's the tether cable that provides the robot with power and commands. And that cable can get tangled up into the various strings or whatever you have in the water. So maybe you can connect one, two, maybe three strings by using a robot. Anything more than that, you're asking for trouble. Now, the industry is working with AUVs, that is autonomous underwater vehicles, but the deepest they go is 600 meters. So until the industry can get to the level of having AUVs for the deep, you have to worry about what damage you can do with your cable. And if you use manned bathyscaphs, again, you have to worry about that bathyscaph getting caught in one of the strings. Okay? It's not obvious that this is the way to go. So in our case, our design is no bathyscaphs, no ROVs, no highly specialized surface vessels. We had to drop this requirement. As you see, we're building our own vessel. All connections have to be made in the air, minimum number of connectors, as passive a system as possible, and a modular system which is redundant and expandable. Redundant, retrievable, and expandable. First thing we did about 10 years ago was to deploy a star about 14 meters in diameter from a ship and hold it in place with a steel wire with power provided locally by batteries and measure the downcoming neutrino flux, as you can see there. You cannot do neutrino astronomy like this. You can measure muons, though, okay? Because the battery packs will not give you power for longer than 3 or 4 hours. So having finished these tests, we designed our detector with the following requirements in mind. The detector must have phototubes looking both up and down, exactly because the Earth absorbs. And if you're going to do hundreds of TV astronomy, you have to be able to look up. It's also nice to measure your background. So we have built stars that are 32 meters in diameter. With the phototubes, we go to almost 34 meters. phototube's looking up and down, and in the center there is a titanium sphere that acts as housing for electronics. These are difficult babies to move around, and that's why we have a second design. This is Russian made. The one before is aluminum made by our German colleagues, and this is titanium with hinged arms. That is, every 5 meters there's a hinge so you can pull it up out or in. It makes deployment much easier. For instance, you can see it in the sea. You can pull on the arms and they come apart. So by stacking 12 of these stars on the vertical about 30 meters apart, we construct an Astro Tower which has an effective area of about 20,000 square meters for TV muons. The way we work on it is it's hooked up to the cable and has a rope which is about 5 kilometers long, and by using this rope we can retrieve it on the surface or deploy it back into the deep, very much like a fisherman deploys his nets. So all connections are made in the air and then slowed down. Electronics, you're not interested. So where are we at now? Okay. So in June 2000, we deployed our cable. Our cable was deployed by a beautiful ship and a stupid cable engineer. He damaged our cable in two different spots. Okay? All the fibers were cut. And then we had to wait until we get another ship, and we had to wait around until January 2002. And this is another beautiful ship with a smart engineer. It's Teneo. It's a Spanish ship. We pulled our cable up, repaired it, and then redeployed the cable with our bottom station, which has a fan out and various instruments. I'll show you what instruments. But the weather went bad and we could not deploy one star as we were planning to. But it was a big step forward because we started recording data from the environmental sensors, like an ocean bottom seismometer. This is the kind of instruments you have or something. You have an ocean bottom seismometer, a current meter, you have the electric fan out and fiber fan out, you have a transmissometer somewhere there. This is an electrode for power return. So this is the bottom station of our detector going into the water. If you want to see how you deploy it slowly. This is the pressure versus time, so it's depth versus time. The experimentalists will recognize, and this is the compass it has on, that though the depth has bottomed out, the compass still shows that it's moving. It bottomed out at 4,096 meters. And it's a strange number because this is how far a 12-bit ADC will count. Okay, we're not planning going that deep that time, and our ADC cannot count more than 4,096. It turns out that we missed by about 40 meters. If you extrapolate with the same rate of descent and the time that we record either from the compass or with the ocean bottom seismometer, it went another 40 meters deeper to 4,136 meters. But this is one of those cute things that happen in experimental physics. These are underwater current meters that were measured with this instrument. But this is not what we want. We want to do neutrino astronomy. Oh, by the way, these are some earthquakes that were recorded by this instrument. So data were transmitted, but not data that we're interested in. And this comes now to this last March. We deployed again our, we recovered, fixed the cable, we had a problem with the cable, and redeployed. And first of all, we deployed the floor also, but this is for those of you that were asking questions about the underwater currents. Okay, this is time in hours. This is the value of the underwater currents, a few centimeters per second. Okay, you can see the diurnal variations. And that's enough. And let's look at the star. I should show you a photograph of the star going into the water, which I have somewhere here. Huh? It's nice to look at the star going into the water. Oh, by the way, this is the ship we used this time, beautiful French ship. It's very important to have this bridge up front, because that's what we use to deploy. And this is the star. This star is only 14 meters across. It's not 32. We have used only the first two parts of it. Just for reasons in deployment, the rest of the system is as in the final detector, 12 phototubes. You are not interested in the stability of the system, so let me go on with what we've been getting. This is the typical output pulse height from one of the phototubes. This is thermionic noise, and this is one and two photoelectrons. You can see the single photoelectron peak here, which is the same as we get from calibration pulses. And there's the second photoelectron. If you add the two, this explains this bump. So the phototubes work very nicely. If you want to look now at bioluminescence, you look at the singles rates of your phototubes, and all of a sudden, you see them going up for about a second or two, then coming down. And this happens in more than one phototube usually. What happens is that the microorganisms in the general area have a party and they start emitting light, okay? And that light is at the single photoelectron level and you detect it. Now we have, and it has been known that this is stimulated by mechanical excitation, okay? So it's at about, as I'll show you the numbers, 1% of the data has to be thrown away. So what you do is you look at your data, and when you see that the organisms are having a party, you see the singles rates of the phototubes going up, you block that part of your data out. And that's your dead time. It's 1% dead time. It's nothing to worry about. But you have to understand it. And if you calculate the chance coincidence, this is the trigger rate. And if you calculate the chance coincidence, you can describe it by chance. So there is no correlation. The light emission is not coherent at the nanosecond level, okay? Now, if you want to look at trigger rates, you can see that most phototubes are running at about 50 kilohertz. This is potassium 40, right? And we understand it. It's flat. The flatness shows that we understand our coincidence and our triggers. It's not something you would be worrying about.
How many phototubes do you have
there? 12. And this is the pulse height that you get for this. The crosses are the bioluminescence events. The bars are the potassium 40, that is, you've blocked out the bioluminescence events. And you can see that the spectral, the pulse height distribution is the same, whether you have potassium 40 or bioluminescence. This is the kind of trigger rate that you get. This is the trigger rate during bioluminescence. This is when the bioluminescence activity is excluded, and I'll show it to you on the same graph to show you that above four folds, above say four or five folds, the bioluminescence is not a problem. Okay? So you run your detector at 4 volts, and whenever you see bioluminescence, you just block that out. And this is, again, is your total trigger rate. The black circles are the bioluminescence. The open circles are the trigger rate that you get experimentally. So how would neutrinos manifest themselves? Well, if it's above the, I'll show you a table. Neutrinos, I should say muons. Let's not talk about neutrinos. If it's above the trigger rate that you, this is the measure, the bar, the lines are the measured trigger rate, the full circles are the accidental coincidence rates caused by either bioluminescence or by potassium 40, and the difference between the measured and the calculated should be muons. And somewhere in there, neutrinos will be buried. At what level? We don't know. Now, I'll show you the same. Graph, but in a table. Now, this table is embarrassingly good. That is, these are the measured rates. This is the accidental coincidence rate. This is the Monte Carlo prediction for atmospheric muons. So if I take the accidental rate of 0.021 and add onto it the 0.052 of the Monte Carlo prediction for atmospheric neutrinos, that should agree with the measured rate. And the agreement is embarrassingly good. I'm embarrassed to show it to you. But that's what came out, so I'm showing it to you. So all I'm trying to say is that buried in there, in the five-fold and above data, at the coincidence level 5 and above, there's atmospheric muons, and we're trying to fit that, and I'll show you that fit in a second. So you're not interested in calibration data, right? Are you? No. You don't want that. I'll just show you three typical events. Okay. This is the detector. Color code is the number of PEs per phototube. 6 amps up and down phototubes. And what you see here is the upper phototubes and the lower phototubes, pulse height versus time. Okay. Now, you can see that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 phototubes have fired, so this is a sevenfold coincidence. And that, the fit to that is a muon that has a zenith angle of 66 degrees plus minus 35, so the error is large, so it's coming from above the horizon, and an impact parameter of about 40 meters. So this is almost there, but not quite. We have to tune our fitter, we hope to get down to about 10 degrees accuracy. This is a bad event, and I'll show you why it's bad, so that you don't tell me that I only show you good events. You can see these are the pulses on the phototubes, and you can see the second pulses. So this event probably is a 2 muon event, but we have fitted it as a single muon. Okay, and that's why the chi-square is bad, 3. We're working on it. And I'll show you another nice event, and that will conclude my talk. So I'm just trying to tell you that we are trying to understand our detector, we're making progress, we're far away from doing neutrinos, we need more than one floor to see neutrinos, but this is an engineering run, if you wish, a run that sort of convinces us that we know what we're doing. And this event gives for a chi-square per degree of freedom of 0.6 and a muon that's 102 plus minus 15. So it comes along the horizon. If we had more than one floor, I'd argue that this could be a neutrino, because there's no way there's going to be a muon coming from a little bit below the horizon. Okay? But I don't think we can prove that with the 12 phototubes we have. Thank you. It's this perpendicular from the center of the floor to the line. Okay? And that's exactly what I was trying to tell to Tom earlier when he said PV neutrinos. Well, it's this impact parameter. The fewer the tubes you have you require to fire, the further out you can see. Okay? So it's a game that you have to answer by trial and error. But the important thing to remember here is you have the C, so you can reach angular resolutions of 1 degree by 1 degree, and it's deep, so you don't have much downcoming background. Okay, this is the message. And this may or may not be a horizontal muon. If it's a horizontal muon, it's a neutrino by definition. Okay, but we got very excited when we fitted that, so I thought I'll show you.
And when you have the full array, are you optimized for TdV? Was that the design?
Yes, the design is hundreds of GV to PEVs. Let me show you exactly what we want to do. Listen, this is again to answer your question. I have to have the right slide here. So, listen, this is the reconstruction efficiency for a track that comes along the vertical but outside the detector. This is the detector limit. So if you have a 10 TeV muon that goes about 70 meters outside the detector, you have a 95% probability of reconstructing it. This is the beauty of being in the clear sea. You can see outside your detector. If you go to 100 TeV, Tom, you can see you have an 80% probability of reconstructing that 100 meters away from your detector. So the next step is obvious.
This was for a single tower.
This is a single tower. So the next step is obvious. I take 7 towers, okay, and I put them about 150 meters apart. Anything that goes in between, we reconstruct with an 80% efficiency from each tower. So everything is reconstructable. Within a tower, the threshold is 5 GV. In between towers, for this distance, the threshold is 1 TeV. So you can do both low energy and high energy at the same time. This is a spherical detector. This is the zenith, the response function. This is 15% of square kilometer. And this is the best approximation to a spherical detector that I know of. And then you can put another set of towers around. But just to jumpstart the game, A is the sensitive, look at B. B is the sensitive area of a tower for 10 degrees or so angular resolution, which is like Amanda has right now, as a function of energy. You can see that at the PV, you have about 60,000 square meters. Now, John and colleagues from Dumont have given us their three strings. If we put the three strings, which we have now, at a distance of about 80 meters around the tower, then we get curve A, which increases the angular resolution, the sensitive area, by about 30%. But now, you want to do astronomy, and I argued for good angular resolution. So with this instrument, let's say, what's the sensitive area if we make the requirement of 5 degrees? 5 degree angular accuracy, okay? And you can see that with the Duman tower, with the Nestor tower and the three Duman strings at the PV, we have 50,000 square meters. And this is hardware which we have now. We have enough hardware to build a tower, and we have the three Duman strings. So this is a significant part of kilometer cube. And in our way, the way to build kilometer cube is just put either towers. Imagine that you are a seagull and you're looking down. Concentric rings of either towers or rings. And the last, we're building a baby. We're building a deployment barge. She's called the Delta Berenike. and she's here. The slow progress that the field is making is due to the fact that in order to operate successfully, you need the random coincidence of good weather and the availability of a ship of opportunity. I'm using the word opportunity because it's cheaper this way, and you cannot afford the high budgets that others can. And that's a few percent. So we try to beat that by building our own vessel. This is a platform, 51 meters in each side, that is self-propelled, and with GPS, she can hold position in the high seas to plus minus 20 meters. It has its own winches, and we can deploy a tower with arms that are almost 100 meters in diameter. And I think this is the way to go. This is a schematic. It's called the Delta Berenike. She has winches. One of them is from Dunand. And that's the way to go. She's going to be berthed in the Bay of Navarino, 15 miles from the theater of operations. And when you see that you're going to get a window, weather window of 3 or 4 days, you go out, you deploy, and you work. We're just sick and tired of, we've been doing this for 15 months until last March, waiting for a ship and good weather. Okay, and that's very frustrating. So, my last slide, truly my last slide. I owe this to Gaius Plinius II. So, rest in peace. Not only we go down vertical mine shafts, but we go to the bottom of the sea and even outer space, and thanks to the taxpayer. So that concludes my talk.
What's the time schedule?
The time schedule. Let me show you. I have so happened that I have the graph for that. This is Poseidon defines the schedule. I'll show you the graph that I was showing a couple of years ago, Sergei. So summer 2002, deep sea deployment of one or two floors. When I showed that in 2002, I had the comment here, standby for availability of ship of opportunity. Then I crossed that out, standing by for good weather, because we had a ship, and in March 2003 we deployed. Okay, so we'll have to pull it up. This is an engineering run. In the next few months, we'll pull it up and replace it with two or more floors, possibly four if we can. With four, we can do physics. We can have a very good discrimination of downcoming to upcoming. And then we'll let that run for a couple of years, and then put a whole tower. And then we'll see.
What is the estimated cost of?
It depends on how you do your bookkeeping. But if you don't have the development costs and the infrastructure costs, a tower is of the order of $3 to $4 million. I can justify that without turning red in my face in public. So it's not that expensive.